loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, and I'm joined in studio by hosts John Kiriakou and Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the Trump administration announced today that organizations with Title X funding will not be able to even say the word abortion any longer. Title X funding is for family planning and healthcare, and Planned Parenthood is one organization that relies on this funding. Next, after a week of intense wrangling, two populist anti-European Union parties have agreed to form a government in Italy. One of the parties, the Five Star Movement, is an eclectic mix of left and right-wing policy proposals, and on the other hand, the Liga Nord is virulently anti-immigrant. Both parties ran on platforms that threaten conflict with the Eurozone and the European Union. Then, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is poised to win re-election on Sunday. Despite widespread unrest because of the country's economic crisis, he maintains a high level of popular support. Meanwhile, many opposition groups have incited violence in the country. And then, Republican Congressman Mo Brooks of Alabama said yesterday that rising sea levels are a result of soil erosion or rocks falling into the ocean, not of climate change. Believe it or not, Brooks is a member of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. And finally, it's Friday. We'll take a look at the worst and most misleading headlines of the week. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to the new attacks on abortion rights from the Trump administration. We're joined from Los Angeles by Danielle Norwood. She is a reproductive rights activist and a therapist specializing in treating adult and adolescent survivors of trauma. Welcome back, Danielle. So this is a pretty intense new attack coming from the Trump administration. Tell us what this new regulation or this new policy means for women.
Sure. Well, essentially, it means that, you know, the agencies that serve low-income women who receive Title X funding, you know, primarily Planned Parenthood, will lose funding from the federal government if they continue to provide abortion services. So what it means is that low-income women will effectively lose access to reproductive health care.
Yeah, and it's particularly Title X funding that's on the chopping block here. What is Title X?
Oh, gosh. Okay. Well, Title X is funding that provides money for reproductive health. You know, so up to now, it has funded birth control, you know, well woman exams, that sort of thing. So what's happening now is they're kind of trying to make a distinction between abortion and other types of reproductive health care. So, you know, one of the sort of, I guess, side effects or maybe other motives behind this move is to, you know, further promote this idea that abortion isn't healthcare when we know that it is, you know, and up until the 80s when it became sort of politicized and made into this wedge for the far right, you know, was a pretty straightforward part of women's healthcare. So effectively, and at least my perception is that it's an attempt to further this idea that, you know, abortion is something that bad people do, and it's something that, you know, is birth control for women who are irresponsible. So, you know, if these clinics continue to provide abortion services, then they will not, you know, get the funding that has been used for all these years to provide so much health care, you know, that low-income women may not get elsewhere.
Yeah, you know, you're right. This is a wedge issue for the far right. I mean, this is like an ideological far right issue. And, you know, Donald Trump, I don't think Donald Trump actually cares about whether or not abortion is legal. You know, certainly for much of his life. I mean, he's, you know, in the New York elite scene. You know, for much of his life, he was actually a Democrat, more or less. But, you know, he's in office now. He's surrounded himself with all these extreme right-wing bigots. And now, you know, his administration has launched serious attacks on reproductive rights. You know, it's a fundamentally political maneuver, right?
It is. And it's being presented as sort of a moral issue. And I think the involvement of Donald Trump, who is, I think, by any measure, not kind of a moral character, just sort of, you know, makes it clear that this isn't about caring about children. It's not about caring about women. It's not about having, you know, a Christian nation or whatever it is that they're using to sell this idea to conservatives or to the religious right. It is a complete political maneuver. It is a power grab. And, you know, on our side, on the part of women and, you know, people who need this reproductive health care, it's very much a power issue. You know, it is taking away one of the most fundamental rights to your own body and the right to health care, you know, the right to choose whether and when to start a family. So, you know, that I buy. I buy the idea that Donald Trump wants to reduce the power that women have in society. I don't buy the idea that Donald Trump cares one way or another about whether we actually have abortions.
Yeah, you know, one of the organizations that's going to be hit hardest if this, you know, if this new rule goes through is Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood has been, you know, a punching bag for the right wing in the United States for quite a long time. Planned Parenthood does a lot of things. I mean, abortions are one of those, you know, and as we were talking about, that's, you know, a woman's right. That's the right of anybody who can have a baby. But Planned Parenthood does lots of other things, too. I mean, this is sort of a more comprehensive attack on healthcare, isn't it?
Yes, and particularly for low-income women, for people who don't have health insurance, for people who don't have access to healthcare anywhere else, and myself included. You know, I've didn't have health insurance for at least 10 years of my life. Planned Parenthood was one of the only places I could go to get any kind of health care. And, you know, you talk to any woman, any person who can have a baby who needs these kind of services, and they will tell you, you know, 100%, whatever their political affiliation, that Planned Parenthood has helped them. And that has been a lifesaver in times when there were very few other options. And so it's not just about abortion. It's about birth control. It's about cervical cancer. It's about mammograms. You know, all these things that are essential to women's health. And often, you know, Planned Parenthood is the only or last resort. You know, STD testing, things that really have a huge impact on your life are now being jeopardized because, you know, the issue of abortion, which is such a small percentage of what they do at Planned Parenthood, not to, you know, undercut how important it is or how essential, but it's a very small percentage of the services they provide. And because, you know, the Trump administration and the far right want to politicize this issue and make it into, you know, kind of a rallying point for conservatives, now these other essential functions are being jeopardized.
Let's go back into history here, because, you know, we've seen how the Democratic Party has, you know, the Democratic Party politicians and Congress have been totally incapable of stopping, you know, Donald Trump's and the Republican Party's other attacks that have been launched, you know, since the 2016 election, or, you know, before that, of course, as well. You know, the right to abortion was won when Richard Nixon was the president. Walk us through this history. I mean, how have people been able to assert their reproductive rights? You know, is it through lobbying? Is it through voting? Is it through something else?
You know, if lobbying or voting worked, we wouldn't be in this position. I don't think, you know, I think that the perception that all changes made in the voting booth kind of lays the blame for these attacks at women's feet or at, you know, at voters' feet, when we're not given, you know, a chance to vote on most of the things that impact our lives. We weren't given a chance to vote on this, you know, reduction of funding for these essential services. And I think if we were, it would become clear that even people who identify as moderates or as conservatives or people who may not have a lot in common with me or with other people who feel so strongly about this would still support funding for Planned Parenthood, because, again, they serve everyone. They serve the community. Even women who do have health insurance or money can still access services there.
And you know, and then another angle to this is that, you know, this new regulation pertaining to Title X funding, which is funding that goes towards reproductive health care, where, you know, anybody who receives that, you're not even allowed to say the word abortion, right? You know, in addition to, of course, being a gross violation of the rights of the patients, people who seek services at these organizations, it's also, I mean, to doctors, right? Isn't this like a pretty serious violation of both, I mean, just basic free speech rights, but also like your professional obligations? Because, you know, as you were saying earlier, abortions are sometimes or are healthcare.
Yeah. And, you know, I think if I were a doctor, I'd be pretty angry. Because, you know, for therapists as well as doctors, the first rule is do no harm. And when the tools that you can use to help people are limited, your ability to ensure that you're not doing harm is limited. You know, think about all the women who need abortions, you know, for medical reasons, you know, pregnancies that end naturally, and it's either, you know, the doctor can go in and remove this no longer living fetus, or you can be forced to deliver a stillborn child, you know, and I know several people this has happened to, and it is extremely traumatic. So, you know, for a doctor to not be able to give women this humane, compassionate option and instead to force them to carry, you know, a dead baby to term is incredibly cruel. And so for politicians to presume to tell doctors how to do their job is just, you know, it's so dystopian. it's so cruel. And I would hope that, you know, I don't know that we've ever seen a large mass movement on the part of doctors, but I would hope that they're going to push back. You know, I would like to see doctors and medical providers and those of us in the helping professions who deal with the fallout of this stuff to organize and to fight back against this kind of thing. Because again, if voting would do it, we'd be there. You know, it takes more than that. It takes more than being on the right side of things, believing that people should have the right to health care. It's going to take fighting for it, clearly.
We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Los Angeles by Danielle Norwood. She's a reproductive rights activist and a therapist specializing in treating adult and adolescent survivors of trauma. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. After a week of intense wrangling, two Eurosceptic parties have agreed to form a government in Italy. One of the parties, the Five Star Movement, is an eclectic mix of left and right-wing policy proposals. And the other, Lega Nord, is virulently anti-immigrant. Both parties ran on platforms that threaten conflict with the Eurozone and the EU. We're joined from London by legendary anti-war activist and former British parliamentarian George Galloway. Welcome back, George, and where are you?
Well, you wouldn't believe it, but I'm sat outside Buckingham Palace in a traffic jam. The whole area is festooned by the British flags and all kinds of bunting because, of course, the country is transfixed, not with the royal wedding tomorrow in Windsor with one of your compatriots. So we're now joined at the hip.
Yeah, it's the, we're coming back together. It's been a long time, ever since, I guess, 1783. But in many ways, we've been joined at the hip since World War II. It's just the relationship changed. Your country, the UK, became a junior partner of this country, or at least its ruling elites.
Our hip was joined to your ankle.
Exactly. George, let's talk about what's happening in Italy.
Well, it's fascinating. It is a big blow to the European Union, to the political establishment, to the prevailing orthodoxy. It's filled with many conflicts to come because, as you just summed up there, the new coalition is a mix of a populist left and right party called Five Star, and a very right-wing party called the Italian League, formerly known the Northern League, but expanding its purview right down to the toe of Italy in the last election. And they reject many things that we also reject. They reject some things that we don't reject, and they support some things we don't support. But one thing that stands out for me as an observer of Italian politics for the best part of half a century is that the giants of the Communist Party and the Christian Democrats have literally disappeared. Not just disappeared in terms of changed names and reformations, but literally disappeared. The orthodoxies are now defunct officially in Italy. And it may be that will catch on in other European countries.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, again, at least for our U.S. audience, George, people won't know, but the Communist Party in Italy, which played such a phenomenal role in the armed resistance against Nazi occupation during the war years, played such a profoundly important role in Italy in every area. in the areas of local governance, in the areas of the labor movement, and political representation. And at least in the post-World War II years, right after the war, the U.S. and the CIA did everything in its power to make sure that no Italian government would include the Communist Party, even though it enjoyed perhaps 30% of the popular vote. It's gone. I mean, it's hard to imagine that in Italy, and yet it didn't just disappear. Can it come back, or can some new iteration of a mass left party come back to Italy?
Well, when you think of the giants that are part of the encyclopedia of left-wing history, Gramsci, Togliatti, even Berlinguer, these were gigantic figures in the worldwide socialist movement. And now they are no more, their party is no more. All the things we remember about the Red Bologna, where the Communist Party were in local government and were culturally a powerful force, as well as a very powerful communist-led trade union movement, all of that is destroyed. And the imperialists did, as you say, everything that they could to stop the Communist Party coming to power, as they should have done at the end of the Second World War, given their role as the vanguard of the anti-fascist resistance, not just against the Nazi occupation, but against Mussolini and fascism in general. And in that struggle, they paid a high price in terms of martyrs and repression and so on. But in this five-star movement, we see some flickers, let me put it that way, of left-wing politics and analysis, a rejection of capitalist globalization, a demand for more democratic control over the Italian economy and society, a rejection of the hegemony of the European Union and its central bank with its neoliberal austerity program, a rejection of austerity itself, demands for more public spending, better benefits, more rights for workers. These are all left-wing planks of the five-star movement's appeal. But of course, being populist, it also takes a view that the European Union cannot instruct Italy to have open borders. And that might be held to be a right-wing position. I myself don't think so. It's certainly not a liberal position. But I wouldn't myself describe it as right-wing. After all, the proper business of the left in Italy is to defend the wages and conditions and the lives of the people already in Italy. The idea that Italy must be open to potentially hundreds of millions of immigrants from elsewhere in Europe, but in reality, certainly many, many millions. Some will say, liberals will say, that this is a right-wing position. I myself don't agree with that.
All right. And among the key policies laid out by the new governing coalition were a two-tiered flat tax, a 780 euro a month basic income for poor families, the repeal of pension reforms introduced at the height of the 2011 debt crisis, and withdrawal of EU sanctions on Moscow. Now, those are progressive positions, as you said. And at the same time, the two parties called for the rapid deportation of, it's an estimated 500,000 migrants on Italian soil. George, you know, one of the things about the current world situation is that there's more people on the move now than any time since the end of World War II. Anytime. It's 60 million people are on the move because of war, because of poverty, because of economic dislocation. And at the same time, the EU countries, along with the United States, have done so much damage militarily and economically to Northern Africa, to the Middle East, to South Asia. I mean, that's the reason so many people are on the move. It's almost a foundational element of modern imperial capitalism.
That's absolutely true. Although there's no reason why Italy should be left to shoulder an entirely disproportionate share of the burden. Everyone has a legal and moral right towards refugees, and the countries creating the refugee flows with their endless wars and invasions and depredations of all kinds have obviously a particular responsibility in that regard. But the refugee flow has not been shared equally across the European Union, and certainly not in the case of Britain, which is one of the key causes of the refugee flow. We take hardly any refugees. Italy and Greece, and Turkey for that matter, which is outside the EU, have taken millions of people. And you can't blame the Italian worker and his family for feeling that this is unjust towards them. And that's what's producing the kind of populist politics that the Five-Star Coalition, but more particularly the Italian League, its coalition partner, have definitely been building their political strength on. And then there's the issue of the difference between refugees and economic migrants. Now, your people probably came to the United States as economic migrants. Mine certainly came from Ireland as economic migrants. Of course, bear no animus towards them. But every country has a right to have a border, have a right to decide democratically how many people it wants to come in from outside at any particular time, dependent on its economic position, its social position, its ability to absorb significant numbers of new people. Again, I think that applying traditional left-right rubrics to that debate is a mistake.
George Galloway, we have 1 minute left. If we were having this discussion in 10 years, where do you think the EU will be in 10 years? It seems such a dynamically unraveling project. Do you see it that way?
I think there'll be no EU in 10 years. There'll be an inner EU which will continue to exist across the extremely prosperous axis of Germany, the Netherlands, Belgium, and France. They'll continue to have some kind of union. The rest is going to fall apart of that, I'm sure. And the Italian development today is a significant harbinger of that.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from London at Buckingham Palace, but in a traffic jam outside the palace, by legendary anti-war activist, organizer, leader, and former British parliamentarian George Galloway. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're joined in this segment from Caracas, Venezuela, by Lucas Kerner. Lucas is an activist and writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. We're going to be talking about the presidential election taking place on Sunday in Venezuela. Lucas Kerner, welcome back.
Great to be here, Brian.
I'm looking at a headline in the New York Times. It's the irony. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the editors are thinking here, but here's the headline. Running, comma, with confidence, comma, to topple a dictator. Kind of ironic, because if Nicolas Maduro is a dictator, there would be no possibility of him actually losing the election on Sunday. But it's an interesting framework for the New York Times, but reflective of how the corporate-owned media here in the United States is treating this election. Anyway, your reaction to that headline, and let's just talk about what's likely to happen on Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, what's funny is if Venezuela were a dictatorship, it wouldn't be having a presidential election. You know, and then the other key fact that it misses out, that Nicolas Maduro was actually elected to a six-year term on April 14, 2013, which, you know, expires on January 10, 2019. So he's serving out his constitutional mandate, which is, you know, conveniently forgotten by the mainstream media. But this kind of goes to show you with the kind of, you know, the mainstream media just basically parrots the opposition line of, you know, they want to have their cake and eat it too. You know, they want to delegitimize the election, but at the same time, they want to paint Henry Falcon, who's the opposition frontrunner, as this champion of democracy. So in case he wins, they'll recognize the election. So it's kind of like their insurance policy that they have going. And they've done this. I mean, they've cried fraud in every election, you know, with the exception of the 2015 December parliamentary election in which the opposition won. So, you know, I think that, you know, Henry Falcón definitely, you know, is seeking to promote a high turnout for this election, you know, to try to defeat Maduro. But, you know, the reality is the opposition has shot itself in the foot because they had all the main opposition parties have called for a boycott and are actively attempting to undermine, you know, this candidate. And, you know, I'm in Miami right now, and my Uber driver was just telling me how he's not going to vote. He doesn't know anybody's going to vote. You know, they're you know, militantly against voting, militantly, you know, against this candidate. So it's a very interesting kind of bizarre setup we have here.
Yeah. And so you're expecting, given the fact that Falcón is running as the opposition, but a big part of the opposition is boycotting, you're expecting Maduro to win?
I think Maduro is going to win, but the question is by how much, how many votes is he going to get? Because, I mean, it's not just that the opposition is boycotting, but it's also the fact that you have the opposition is divided. There is not a unitary candidate. You have the Pentecostal preacher, Javier Bertucci, who's going to win probably, you know, maybe 10% or more of the vote, you know, trying to capitalize on this evangelical wave that's sweeping the region right now. And, you know, many people who might otherwise vote for Falcón. So there's definitely that going. And, you know, the fact is Falcón is not a, you know, nationally renowned, nationally popular figure. He's very uncharismatic. He just lost his reelection bid in October by a landslide. So, you know, he definitely is not viewed as someone. And, you know, he's being actively delegitimized by the very opposition. But the question with, you know, with Maduro is, you know, how many votes is he able to mobilize? I mean, we can definitely, he definitely has a floor of, you know, say 6.5, you know, 6.5 million votes, I would say at least, you know, probably 7. You know, but he's promising 11. He was trying to get over 50% because that's what he needs, you know, to really ensure his legitimacy. And, you know, I think to really, that would be a massive blow to the United States and to the opposition if he were to win that. But it remains to be seen whether he can mobilize those numbers.
I can predict, Lucas, that if Maduro wins, and especially if he gains 50% of the vote, that the Western media and the opposition will say that this was a fraudulent election. Do you expect the same?
I would see no reason not to expect that, given, you know, that every other election that they have cried fraud, even you know, the elections like the gubernatorial election in October, on October 15th of last year, in which the opposition won for, you know, strategic governorships, you know, yet they cried fraud. I mean, this is their strategy. They already announced in advance. There's no surprise. They are not going to recognize the result of this election. Unless, you know, through some, you know, unexpected, you know, possibility that we're not foreseeing in this moment, which is possible. We're, you know, post-2016 moment now that, you know, Falcón manages to win, you know, which I don't think is likely. But that's the only, even if he were to win, that would be present a very interesting scenario because I'm not sure that they even want to work with Falcón. I think that, because remember, the United States, you know, reportedly threatened to sanction Henry Falcón for violating the opposition boycott. So he's not someone that they perceive as he's not their man. That's the reality.
Very interesting. Let's talk about the economic situation. It is, of course, dominating the media coverage here. Maduro and the Socialist Party are blamed for the economic crisis that's gripping the country. What's going to happen? I mean, is there a way to get control of inflation? Is there a way to stop the free fall in the country's currency? And also, right now, oil prices are starting to climb. Well, not starting. They have climbed dramatically. Anyway, what's next? Like, if Maduro prevails, what will the government do to try to gain control or get control over the economic situation to improve the economic situation?
Well, Maduro's basically campaign promise is, you know, vote for me, elect me on May 20th, and I will resolve the economic situation. You know, and the problem is he promised the same thing after, you know, last August, you know, last July after the National Constituent Assembly elections, and yet they didn't take measures. You know, they're very risk averse, but, you know, perhaps with this election, you know, now that if they win this presidential election, they'll have won the mayoral elections, they would have won the governorship elections, that, you know, now there's no more elections they could possibly have, and they have no more, they can't continue to kick the can down the road, and they really will need to take, you know, decisive economic measures. We'll see. I mean, clearly the key issue is the foreign exchange system that's absolutely broken, that you have a official exchange rate that's at some 80,000 bolivares to the dollar, but you have a black market rate that's upwards of 850 or close to 900,000 bolivares to the dollar. So you need an efficient way of, you know, floating the currency while at the same time, you know, protecting the population from, you know, the consequences of that and being able to allocate, you know, state dollars to those businesses that are actually going to produce and are actually going to import instead of committing fraud against the people. So, I mean, that this is clearly, I anticipate that, I'm not sure if he's going to take measures on that. I would like to believe so, but I think that it may be, they're too risk averse on that, but they're definitely going to probably receive, financing. They just signed a deal with Turkey to import massive amounts of food and medicine for May 20th. I think you can see similar deals that they're going to sign with Russia and China, I think a victory will definitely shore up the confidence of the Chinese, perhaps, to, give them a further loan. The oil industry is really in dire straits. Production has fallen from 3 million barrels like in 2012 to it's now 1.6. It's the lowest level since the late 80s. And this is, really due to lack of investment. They just do not have the funds to invest. And it's very difficult for a state company to maintain, an extremely expensive, and as well as heavy crude is extremely expensive to produce. So they're going to really need to attend to all of these different fronts of, and resolving the shortages of medicine, which is, really an issue. And, hopefully these imports will point towards that. But there's a lot of issues on the table that they need to take bold steps.
Yeah. What's been the main reason, from your opinion, from your point of view, for the aversion of risk? Why not go for it? Is it because the Maduro's internal sort of political organization is divided about what to do and thus they can't take decisive action? Or is there something else?
I think there's a combination of factors. I think the first, there's an ideological issue that unfortunately there's a lot of economists, that are advising the government, like Alfredo Serrano Mancilla, who, actually defends, they interpret Chavez implemented exchange controls after the 2002 oil lockout, as a mechanism of averting capital flight. And arguably in that moment, it was necessary and averted that flight. But afterwards, it became this extremely perverse mechanism in which basically the state dollars could be allocated and bought at an extremely low rate, say 6 or 10 bolivars to the dollar, and then sold at many times that in the black market. And this, this continues to be, a very perverse dynamic that's in place. And, unfortunately, there's definitely an ideological fixation that if we do this, the government will fall because it's going to, if we really do take action, all the prices are going to shoot up and we're going to have a Caracazo. We're going to have a repeat of the 1989 uprising in which, neoliberal reforms were taken. I mean, this would not be a neoliberal reform. It would be a necessary liberalizing reform, but it could be done in a way in which you ensure social investment, you promote neighborhood soup kitchens, you have direct subsidies to the people instead of indirect subsidies that, shield people from the brunt of that. So, and then a lot of that infrastructure is already in place through the homeland system, through the CLAPs, these direct food distribution networks. So, it's in place. But I think there's also a broader, a deeper problem that within the state, it's a bourgeois state and there's a lot of corruption and a lot of elements within the state and, even within the government who are benefiting from this, perverse exchange rate dynamic and are gaining access to these subsidized dollars. And they don't, they don't want to let go of the honeypot, really. And I think that's something that has to be confronted.
Yeah, it's such an unusual dynamic because you have a socialist government, but the state itself is not socialist. I mean, there's been an incrementalism and an effort to purge and to reform and to legislate step by step efforts to, to go to a new place with a socialist perspective. But again, confronted by the reality that there are many entrenched interests who are vested interests and who are benefiting. In our last minute, Lucas, what about the Constituent Assembly? How much of a force is it in Venezuelan society, or will it be if these new economic programs, the ones you're suggesting, were to be implemented?
Well, I mean, the problem with the Constituent Assembly is it basically became, instead of becoming a medium for the mass of people to channel their demands, through the state and really, a lightning rod for these demands to push forward transformations, kind of basically became acting as kind of a rump parliament in which it would basically just implement many of the same policies that Maduro wanted to implement anyway. So it never really became a decisive actor on its own. So I think that, the key is, The National Constituent Assembly elections, 8 million people came out and voted. That was a massive expression of not necessarily support for Maduro, but rejection of the opposition, campaign to overthrow the government and rejection of the economic crisis and a bid to resolve it on terms of revolutionary advance. I think that if we have a big showing for Maduro, it's not going to necessarily be an endorsement of Maduro, but it's going to be an endorsement of the need to push forward in a revolutionary direction. I think that's the biggest hope, that a great outpouring of popular support will be, it will be a vote against Trump, and it'll be a vote against the economic warfare and a vote for, following Chavez in continuing the revolutionary process and deepening and radicalizing. I think that's the best hope that the Venezuelan people have at this point.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined from Caracas, Venezuela by Lucas Kerner. You can read his writings at VenezuelaAnalysis.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Republican Congressman Mo Brooks of Alabama said yesterday that rising sea levels are a result of soil erosion or rocks falling into the ocean, not of climate change. Believe it or not, Brooks is a member of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. We're joined from Burlington, Vermont by Fred Magdoff. Fred is a professor emeritus of plant and soil science at the University of Vermont. He's the co-author of the book, What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism. And he's also the author of Creating an Ecological Society Towards a Revolutionary Transformation. Fred Magdoff, welcome back.
Good to be back.
Here's what Brooks said, the congressman. What about erosion? Every time you have that soil or rock, whatever it is, that is deposited into the seas, that forces the sea levels to rise because now you've got less space in those oceans because the bottom is moving up. Wow, that's deep, man.
The reality is that, you know, if you do put, if you throw a rock into the ocean, it's displacing some water, you know, and so it's just like if you've got a glass and you put a rock into it, I mean, it doesn't break the glass, the water level will rise. So the phenomenon, you know, is not that crazy, although the congressman is crazy, because the explanation is quite clear. I mean, the glaciers are melting. Water is being added. The rising sea temperatures, which are measured, I mean, this is not hypothetical, causes water to expand. So that you don't have to look to any other, you know, explanations than those. You know, there's enough water that's being lost by glaciers coming into the oceans. Also, by the way, overpumping of groundwater is contributing to a certain extent also. Some of that ends up in the oceans. So, you know, it's a question of proportion. You know, sure, what he's talking about is like a speck. And what the reality is like a tsunami, you know. It's happening very rapidly, accelerating somewhere around 3 millimeters a year. That's like over an inch every 10 years. And that's happening because of water that's being added that was previously on land and was a glacier. So from Antarctica and from Greenland mainly.
Well, let's talk about the groundwater phenomenon. Just explain what you mean by that.
Well, groundwater is being pumped out for use for irrigation. It's being pumped out for use for drinking water, etc. And then some of that ends up in streams, and the streams end up in the ocean. So that it does happen that groundwater, you know, is contributing to a small extent. To ocean rise. In other words, this is water that would have been in deposits on land, you know, deep down, 100, 200, 300 feet down, it's brought to the surface, and some of it just ends up in the stream, and some of that what's in the stream is going to end up in the ocean. So it's not a big phenomenon, but it's something that's at least worth mentioning. The major issue is the melting of the ice. And the thermal expansion. I mean, those are the major two issues of what's causing the sea levels to rise.
You've been watching this, observing this, writing about this for a long time. If we had had this discussion, say 30 years ago, did you anticipate the melting of the glacial melting that we're witnessing at the rate that we're witnessing, or are you surprised?
Well, I mean, the scientists who study it, which I'm not one of them, they're surprised. And, you know, all I know is what I read, you know, the results of studies. And, you know, it's happening more quickly than people had anticipated. One of the explanations is, they're trying to look for explanations to why it's happening more quickly. And just one of them is that that there is soot, you know, that's in the atmosphere that comes down on the ice and makes it darker, you know, sort of creates a darker surface, which then absorbs more heat you know, from the sun, and that for therefore just below that layer, it makes the ice that much warmer. So, I mean, that's one of the explanations that people are looking at. So it's, in essence, pollutants in the form of particles that darken the surface of the ice that cause it to melt even faster. So, no, it seems to be accelerating, and, you know, who knows how much it will accelerate or just keep, you know, keep going its merry way. And at the same time, of course, I think I've mentioned this before, but it's important that, you know, some of the land is sinking. There is land subsidence. New Orleans, Norfolk, Virginia is one of them, is another one that's where a major naval base is. The Navy knows that the seas are rising, and the Navy knows why, and they have an extra problem in that their land at their major naval base, the largest in the world, is sinking. Now you put the two together, and you've got problems.
Yeah, Norfolk will disappear.
Well, eventually, a good part of it. A good part of it will.
Yeah, if it's sinking and the sea waters are rising. I mean, you mentioned, again, the number 1 inch every 10 years for sea levels to rise. To a layperson, that sounds like, okay, no big deal. What's 1 inch? But it is a big deal. Talk about magnitudes here, if we could.
Yeah, first off, it's over an inch, but let's just call it an inch. The thing is that a lot of what happens, the damage that's done, is not done from the ordinary sea level. Okay, it happens when there's storms and there's swells, and you get storm surges, like when a hurricane comes up the east coast of the United States. You get storm surges associated with it if it's in the right position, and that causes the seas to be much higher than normal. Okay, so it's pushing water towards the shore, and you get flooding, especially if it's a high tide. It's worse. There are conditions which can make it even worse. And so what's happening is that these and just even the high tide, just with some winds, it doesn't have to be a complete storm surge, can cause problems. Miami Beach is one of the places that suffers from that a lot. So it's not just the level of the sea. It's just as the level gets higher, it means that the storm surges are going to be higher, especially if the storms are more intense. And it means that just normal storms, not these hurricanes that really push water, that create a lot of waves, can do more damage. And so it's a significant effect.
Yeah. Let me ask you, Fred Magduff, about your book, What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism. What does every environmentalist need to know?
Well, you got to read the book if you want to know the whole story. Let me boil it down.
Yeah, thank you.
Essentially, we have an economic system, that is capitalism, that has to keep growing. It does grow naturally, the way it normally functions, and it has to keep growing, and if it's not growing, it's in crisis. And number one, you can't have infinite growth on a finite world. It's just not possible. It just can't. You're using more and more resources, et cetera, et cetera. So there's that aspect. Another aspect is, as decisions are made by companies who are making the economic decisions about what to produce and how to produce it, where to produce it, profit is essentially the only thing that is looked at, unless they're forced by regulations to look at something else, like an environmental effect. And so if you're just looking at profits and saying, well, how can I get the most profits from doing whatever I'm doing, a mining operation or production of something or whatever, then what happens is there are environmental side effects, which they call externalities. That's the terminology. But these are really side effects of the way the system normally functions, because they're not taken into account when decisions are made. And that includes, by the way, social problems that occur also, not just environmental ones. So you put those two together, and you have a situation where you're always creating crises. You're always creating new problems. They're introducing new chemicals into the environment without proper testing because they think they're going to make money out of it. So if nobody forces them to do it, that's what they do. If they're producing something and they have a byproduct that they can pour down a drain that goes into a close river, they'll do it unless there's a regulation saying that they can't do it. And even then, they might do it. So you have tremendous amounts of pollution that are associated with the reality that these issues are just not taken into account in a capital system by the way it functions.
It's fascinating. And I want to come back and talk about those concepts, the foundational or fundamental expansionism of capitalism or capitalist production, and the fact that minus regulation, severe regulation, the capitalists will do what they need to do to attract investor capital, which is to maximize profit rather than protecting the environment. Anyway, we want to talk about that more. I want to encourage our audience to get Fred Magdoff's book. It's What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism. It's published by Monthly Review Press. So if you go to the internet, Monthly Review, look for the book, Fred Magdoff, What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism. Fred is also the author of Creating an Ecological Society Towards a Revolutionary Transformation. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Again, this week, we talk, as we do every Friday, about the funniest, the worst, and the most misleading headlines. Joining us from San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at Left Eye, that's L-E-F-T-I, .blogspot.com. And we're also joined by Nicole Rossell. She is a producer of this show. Nicole, Steve Pat, let's talk about headlines.
Let's talk about headlines.
Okay, glad to be here.
I see that we've taken a real major step forward in terms of the organization of this segment by breaking out the headlines between the worst and the most misleading headlines and funny headlines, and I guess disgusting headlines. But let's start with funny headlines. Steve Pat, what's funny? This is a test, by the way.
Funniest headline has received fairly wide circulation on the internet, but it's worth mentioning anyway. Donald Trump and Sean Hannity like to talk before bedtime.
Okay, Donald Trump and Sean Hannity like to talk before bedtime. Okay, that's a funny headline. Okay, let's go to another funny headline.
This one is actually my favorite. Russia-linked Facebook ads targeted a sketchy Chrome extension at teen girls. So here, this is more evidence for interference in the election. It just keeps piling up. These ads got a whopping total of 80 clicks, by the way, and they targeted 14 to 17-year-old girls and stole their information and messaged their friends, and it stole their contacts. And this is my favorite line from the article. This was from an article in Wired. The game wants contacts from your phone. In the hands of a group like the IRA, the Internet Research Agency, that kind of unchecked power can go very wrong. Yes, they could have the names and email addresses of every 14 to 17-year-old girl in the country. Just imagine what they could do with that.
It's chaos. Wow.
They could really mess with your social status that way.
Let's go to another one. This one's about dolphins.
Yeah. It's also bizarre. Ukraine says military dolphins captured by Russia went on hunger strike.
Wait a second. That's deliberately funny. No, maybe not.
No, it's hard to tell. I read this article. It's from The Guardian. At first, I really thought it was a spoof, but maybe it is, but I don't believe so. It's really, there was apparently dolphins being trained in Crimea for military purposes.
Okay, I'm seeing it now. Wait a second. Here's The Guardian. Ukraine says military dolphins captured by Russia went on hunger strike. Russia, subtitle, Russia captured the dolphins in 2014 and says the trained mammals refused interact with coaches or eating. Now, we know people can go on hunger strikes, Nicole. Maybe dolphins can go on hunger strikes. But the question that I have is, how are the dolphins discerning the difference between their, say, Ukrainian teachers and coaches and the Russians who captured them? What's going on here?
Well, dolphins are one of the smartest animals. I mean, I'm sure this is a political statement by the dolphins. Absolutely.
And do you think, Steve, it was because of the annexation of Crimea that the dolphins did this hunger strike?
Well, it's hard to tell. According to this article, there's at least some evidence these dolphins were dead by 2014 when they were allegedly captured or had been sold to commercial entities, quote unquote. So the whole accuracy of this story is, let's say, is in question. In fact, the last, very last paragraph of the article, which again comes from this reputable paper, The Guardian, says there's plenty of disinformation floating around, and it's difficult to independently verify what really went on at the secret dolphin training facility in Crimea. So who knows? I somehow doubt that military dolphins actually went on hunger strike. It seems rather improbable.
Flipper was captured by Russians.
I'd like to go to one of our most misleading headlines next, which I actually thought was funny as well in its own way. U.S. Here's the headline from the Washington Post. U.S. fighter jets intercept Russian bombers off Alaska coast. You know, oh my God, that sounds horrible. How far off the Alaskan coast were these Russian bombers? Well, they were 55 miles off. Now, here's a quiz for you. How far away is Russia from Alaska at the narrowest point?
400 miles.
No, the answer is 55 miles. Exactly the same distance that these Russian bombers were off the Alaskan coast.
So they were actually just off the Russian coast.
Exactly. Well, we don't know where they were.
Did Sarah Palin see them, by the way?
Not in the article, so I think we'll have to assume.
Right out our window, I'm sure.
I think she can see Russia. So if they were right off the Russian coast, she could still. Anyway, let's go on. Those were funny. Let's go on to disgusting headlines. Oh my God, I'm looking. And we talked a little bit earlier about this ridiculous headline about Venezuela.
Yeah, critics, this is from the New York Times. Critics say he can't beat a dictator. This Venezuelan thinks he can. The Venezuelan presidential elections are coming up on Sunday. And apparently you can be a dictator, but still run for election, according to the New York Times, even with the possibility of defeat, and still lose. So they have a rather strange definition of the word dictator.
There's an even better one from the New York Times. Running, comma, with confidence, comma, to topple a dictator. So here you have Nicolas Maduro, who actually won the election. He's there not because he's a dictator, but because he won the election last time. And now he's running again. And while he might win, he's likely to win, I think, because of the divided character of the opposition. He might lose. Would he still be a dictator? Would he still be a dictator if he loses the election on Sunday?
In the pages of the New York Times, I think, and the Washington Post, I think that's pretty much guaranteed, yes.
He will be a dictator regardless of whether he wins democratically or loses or anything, I'm sure.
Actually, the interesting breaking news on this story is that in order to promote democracy in Venezuela, Canada has just prevented the Venezuelan consulates and embassy in Canada from holding elections for expatriates in Canada. So they're preventing Venezuelans from voting in order to help Venezuela's democracy, according to the Canadian government.
And what about that champion of Venezuelan democracy? That would be Nikki Haley. I see another headline from the Washington Examiner. Nikki Haley, : Maduro's snap election will, quote, destroy Venezuela's democracy, close quote. So look, Maduro is called an election. He is a dictator, but he's called an election where he could lose the election. And when he did that, when he called the election, according to Nikki Haley, he's destroying Venezuela's electoral democracy, which doesn't exist because he's a dictator. But wait.
Yeah. Don't try to let your head, try not to let your head explode, but with this logic.
We only have a couple minutes left. I'm really disgusted by the Washington Post again every day. I'm looking at their editorial headline. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, their editorial, which is disgusting, as you say, Hamas has launched another war. Israel needs a better response. I mean, it's an outrage, to put it mildly.
So Hamas used to be attacked for launching rockets. Now, apparently, peaceful protesters are another form of Hamas warfare. And Israel, who shot down these unarmed protesters and shot thousands of them, killed, you know, more than 60. It needs a better response.
I mean, I don't disagree there.
But what a disgusting headline.
These protests were not organized by Hamas. There was even an op-ed in the New York Times by the guy who originally organized the protests. But it's no matter. If there was one Hamas person there, it's Hamas, according to Israel and according to the Washington Post and New York Times as well. I'd like to end on a positive note. There was a lot of attention in the in social media about some of the other disgusting headlines about Monday's killings. For example, here's one from the New York Times. At least 37 Palestinians die in protests, as if they just all had a heart attack or, you know, died of old age.
Yeah, they died. No, they were murdered, everybody. They were shot dead.
Exactly. And a similar headline in the BBC website. But in both the New York Times and the BBC, and I believe some others as well, later on, those headlines were changed. So the New York Times, which started out with at least 37 Palestinians died, had to change their headlines after people complained to Israel kills dozens at Gaza border as U.S. embassy opens. So complaining about these things does occasionally have an effect, and it is worth doing.
Yeah, they were just embarrassed and shamed for their disgusting, lying headlines. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at Left Eye. That's L-E-F-T, the letter I, .blogspot.com. We've also been joined by Nicole Rossell. She's a producer of this show. We'll be back on Monday. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and 1390 AM. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can also hear us at SputnikNews.com. You can subscribe to Loud and Clear at iTunes or now at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. Thank you.